Surgery in a War Zone, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Samer Attar is a Chicago-based surgeon, but he just got back from volunteering at a hospital in Aleppo, Syria.
The area is being bombarded by helicopters and jets in the sky. You're always pressing your luck, and it might be a one-way trip.
Also, a Marine veteran says Donald Trump needs to understand why Muslim Americans choose to serve.
We are loyal to this nation. We want what's best for the United States and for our citizens. And we're willing to sacrifice just as much, if not more, than anybody else.
Plus, an Albanian band called PMS.
The songs themselves are four angry girls telling the world to go. I can say that.
Those stories ahead on The World. We start today with two stories about the conflict in Syria. In a few minutes, we'll hear about an underground library in a suburb of Damascus, where people can go and read books that were rescued from destruction. First, though, we're going to talk about the situation in Aleppo, once Syria's thriving biggest city. Now, the eastern part of that city and the rebels in it are under a government siege. The United Nations says about 300,000 residents are trapped there as well, as fighting continues between the two sides.
The situation is dire and desperate because the city is sealed off. They're stuck.
That's Samer Attar. He's a surgeon who recently spent several weeks volunteering at a hospital in Aleppo. He's back in Chicago now, where he lives. And I should warn you, his stories about the time he spent in Aleppo include some disturbing details. Attar says hospitals in the city, like the one he worked in, are also underground.
They're like bunkers. There are barrels on the outside. There are sandbags lining the windows. All it took was one missile or one bomb. And you'd be working for hours. After a market was bombed or a school or a residential area was bombed, the ER was overcrowded. It was chaotic, full of people injured, full of family members looking for the injured. There were horrifying scenes of dismembered bodies, obliterated limbs. You're literally seeing people bleeding to death in front of you, and there's very little you can do. You're running from one person to the next.
Sounds
it's difficult
ghastly.
And overwhelming.
And what were you able to work with? What kind of tools were available to work with as a surgeon?
The tools are very basic. So you have scalpels and sutures, some anesthesia. The power tools we'd use to drill pins or screws into bones or to perform amputations were just, they're no different than a power tool you'd buy at a hardware store. So very, very basic and rudimentary.
You've been to Aleppo a number of times since the war in Syria started. How did this most recent trip compare to earlier trips in terms of what's worse, what's better? Operating as a doctor there?
This trip was the worst because the intensity of bombardment was just substantial. Almost every day, sometimes twice in a day, you'd see those scenes I was talking about of just an emergency room overrun with critically injured people, scores of them. And we were making so many more critical life-saving decisions, like deciding who to give blood to at the expense of someone else. Or one scene that I'll never forget is when we were doing CPR on this child, young child, whose right leg was obliterated, and he wasn't conscious, he wasn't breathing. And there was a man next to him who was on the ground on the floor, because we just didn't have enough beds, who was conscious but was bleeding from a traumatic amputation of his right thigh. His right thigh was just, everything below it was missing. And the chief surgeon just calmly said to me, "You have to stop working on this child and focus on, I need you focusing on the man who's bleeding to death on the ground, because he has a better chance of making it." That's what I remember. Mm. You never walk away from that.
You worked with a neurosurgeon, the last remaining one in Aleppo. You mentioned he had a sense of humor. How do you maintain a sense of humor in such a difficult circumstance?
Actually, everyone I worked with had a sense of humor. There's a general surgeon there who's also young. He's in his early 30s. And one day there was an airstrike, a missile that we heard the jet screech by, and we heard the missile coming, and it landed so close to the hospital, it knocked me off my feet. And so my heart was pounding and racing a bit, but the people around me were a bit unfazed. This is kind of what they deal with. And one man, one of the administrators in the hospital, started serving everyone tea. And this general surgeon started telling a story where he grew up. He has a farm, and he has a bunch of chickens, and there's a fox that is always eating his chickens, and he was telling all the stories about how he tried to poison the fox unsuccessfully 7 times. And for me, it was a bit surreal because he was just very calm, very composed, and trying to put everyone else at ease.
I read that the nurses that you work with there are a few women, but mostly they're young men. Tell us about them.
I would say over half of the people that work there have no real formal medical training. They're just people who have worked, who have volunteered in these hospitals and who work there. We didn't have an anesthesiologist, an anesthesia doctor. We had four kids. I call them kids because they were in their early 20s, and they're always talking about football, and they would run outside to play football in spite of the bombs and missiles, which you could hear in the distance. For me, it was just an honor to be among them because this is their life. This is what they do every day. They all live in these hospitals solely for the purpose of helping their community.
You've been to Aleppo a number of times since the Syrian war started. How do you get in and out?
You walk across the Turkish border. I was with a group of local Syrian doctors who know the routes, and these are good people who I trust, and we drive to Aleppo. The hospital has drivers whose function is to take supplies and medics and rescue workers back and forth. Before I went, there were multiple roads leading into Aleppo, but with advances by Syrian government forces, there was only one road called the Castella Road, and that road has been intensely bombarded for the past 3 months. And so you're sort of running the gauntlet because the area is being bombarded by helicopters and jets in the sky. You're always pressing your luck, and it might be a one-way trip. As you're driving, you're seeing the remains of cars which have been hit by missiles and rockets, and some of them were still burning, and the air had the stench of just rotten flesh. I only did it twice, but every time the driver said, "Whatever you believe in, say a prayer," because whether or not you made it through was based on luck. The day I left was the day the road was permanently cut. I left at 3 a.m. under the cover of darkness. My driver knew the road by heart and drove with no headlights. And this guy isn't a doctor. He's a volunteer who's risking his life every single day to help other people. He is saving lives, too. So he saved my life.
What do you want now to happen? I mean, who are you speaking to? What help does Syria need the most, and who should provide that help?
The answer isn't more humanitarian aid. It's not sending more doctors to Syria or more supplies. You ask any doctor inside Aleppo what is one thing the international community can do to help them, and their first response isn't for more medicine or more aid. They will ask for protection, specifically protection from the skies. And I think stopping these airstrikes, a no-fly zone would be one way. We have air forces from multiple countries which have been flying over Syrian airspace for the past close to 2 years, and very little has been accomplished to help Syrian civilians who are under this daily bombardment.
Samer Attar is a surgeon who lives in Chicago. He's a volunteer with the Syrian American Medical Society and the Aleppo City Medical Council. He recently spent several weeks volunteering at a hospital in the Syrian city of Aleppo. Thanks, Samer.
Thank you very much.
Let's turn now to that story about the secret library I mentioned earlier. It's in the basement of a house in the Damascus suburb of Duraya. The area has been under siege for the past 5 years. Some residents managed to leave before the siege started. The rest struggle to survive on a daily basis. Amid the chaos and destruction, though, there's this secret underground library. It gives residents a bit of hope and distraction. My BBC colleague Mike Thompson has reported on this. Mike, how did the idea for the library come about?
It was started by three or four young men who are all former students. They were studying at university, and when the war came, of course, it interrupted their studies, and the siege totally finished the studies off. And so the idea was to try and collect enough books so that they could not only be entertained, but could continue their education, and also provide books for school children, because the schools had few books, and many were in basements now, and finding it very tough to continue their schooling.
Where do they get the books?
Well, that's an interesting story. They went around ruined, abandoned buildings, most of them bombed, and looked amongst the rubble for books that they could rescue from these places, many of them homes, some of them public buildings where they'd had some sort of library, whether it's a literary library or perhaps a specialist technical library. And often under sniper fire, they collected these books. They told me that they often had to hide behind walls and wait until a sniper who was looking out for people had fired a few shots so they could work out where he was, and then they'd take appropriate cover and carry on collecting. Really quite extraordinary dedication to literature, I have to say.
So what kind of books would you find there?
You could find just about everything. They were telling me about medical books, dental books, Shakespeare, Arabic poetry, Arabic literature, all kinds of things. Even they told me explicit books. They said they had them on the top shelf for young couples who were about to get married. They said, we put them there so that we can keep the teenagers away from them.
Now, you spoke with one of the people who came up with the idea for this library. What did he tell you?
He told me that what they needed to do was to try and carry on their education. And it was not just so they could pass exams in the future, but they think of themselves, many of these young people, as being the sort of future, if you like, for Syria when President Assad has gone. And so they plan for the future. They try and they hold talks as well as read books. They hold talks on countries like Japan and Germany that obviously lost the Second World War and were in ruins. And yet these countries managed to resurrect themselves. And they say, you know, we read about that and talk about that. And we try and work out whether we can learn from this, including looking across the border at Iraq and saying, can we manage to avoid at the end of the war continuing bloodshed that's been going on next door?
What subjects were these young men studying before their studies were curtailed by war?
Well, one was studying medicine. One was studying, in fact, two were studying engineering. And I talked to one schoolboy, actually, who's the deputy librarian. He lives very near to the library. And he went down there after being, he didn't know it existed because it's secret. And only word of mouth tells people where it is. But the streets were so dangerous that people suggested on the streets that he went there to take shelter. And he loved the place and said, it's just fantastic for me because I was fearing that my education was completely gone. And when the war was over, I'd have no qualifications and no future. And he's been there every day and so dedicated and got to know the library so well that they made him a deputy librarian with his own desk. And so he's there every day signing books in, signing them out. All the usual sort of procedures that happen in libraries, he's watching out for.
Wow. Daraya is a besieged town. There's constant shelling. How can people focus on books and a library?
Well, that's a very good question, Carol, and one I was asking them. I said to them, you know, at a time when you're being shelled daily, where more than 2,000 people have died since the siege began, how can you think of books? I mean, particularly, too, when there's hardly any food. Most people have no more than one meal a day, and that's a sort of watery affair filled with the odd lentil or two swilling around in it. So they're very, very hungry. Many of them have been injured, living in constant fear. And so why books? And also, why aren't you at the front line? Don't your fellow fighters, don't they say, your comrades at arms, don't they say, why aren't you helping us repel the Assad forces? And they said, well, we are here to try and plan for when the fighting's finished, and we see no point in fighting unless you're truly aware what you're fighting for. And we find a lot of the information and a lot of the answers to this in books. And these books seem to not only educate, but they seem to also motivate. In fact, people said that they motivate and they inspire. And I can tell you, when I asked one of them, there's an old saying that the pen is mightier than the sword. Do you agree with that? And one of the founders of the library said, I don't think you need even ask me that question. It's so utterly and totally true.
BBC's Mike Thompson telling me about a secret library in a besieged town near Damascus, Syria. Thanks, Mike, for speaking with us.
Pleasure.
Coming up, feijoada is a Brazilian stew. It's a meat lover's dream with plenty of pig parts. But one restaurant in Rio is making a vegan version and trying to sell the idea to locals and tourists alike.
My advice is not telling them that it's vegan. They won't know there is tofu inside.
Or will they? Stick around and find out in a few minutes. You're listening to The World. It's almost time. The 2016 Rio Olympics officially get underway on Friday. So a lot of people are starting to get excited about the games, the pageantry, and all the sporting competitions. But I have to say, the run-up to these Olympics has been kind of rough. Zika, political scandals, dirty water, unfinished rooms for athletes, not to mention the killing of an Olympic mascot. And the torch almost going out. In fact, there have been a lot of bad omens preceding the Rio Games. The world's man in Rio, Will Carlos, has compiled some of them over at PRI.org. But in spite of all the bad signs, Will says he's still got Olympic fever.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, more sort of, it's a little bit daunting just knowing how much is going to be going on and how many people are going to be focused on this city. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely exciting. We've been working up to this and to see everything kind of come together is going to be fun.
Of course, we're getting those pre-Olympics, it's going to be a disaster kind of stories, things like the athletes being robbed and sailing venues falling apart. What's your take on that? Is it kind of a lot of hot air, or do you think there's an issue about Brazil really being ready?
I mean, I think it's both. I think that what happens is that you have these kind of little teething problems and then people make a big deal out of it, partly because there are a lot of journalists in town who really don't have very much to do until the games start.
What about the environment, though? We've heard a lot about water problems and air problems. What's the real concern here?
When it comes to the environmental things, I think I can completely turn things on its head and say that people perhaps haven't paid enough attention to just how bad things are. And you're right, there's a report that came out today from Reuters, an excellent report on just how bad the air pollution is in Rio. They estimate that it kills more than sort of 5,000 people a year. The water is absolutely foul in this city and it's not getting any better. And so, yeah, I think in that case, the attention's really warranted. I mean, the problems are bad. I mean, for example, I saw today that the sailors and the other Olympians who are going to be close to the water have been advised not to submerge their head in the water, which pretty much sounds ludicrous, but for people who live here, that makes perfect sense. You don't go out into the Guanabara Bay and get underwater. It's just not nice.
Will, you know Brazil pretty well. You partly grew up there. You're now a reporter there. Do you think that there could be real problems at these Olympics? Or do you think, like many other countries in the past, the country will rise to the occasion and everything will go off all right?
A bit of both. I'm sure there are going to be problems. I'm sure there are going to be huge issues with getting around the city. The traffic problems are going to be really bad, I think, during the Olympics. But on the whole, they have spent years and billions of dollars planning for this and getting ready for it. And if Brazil knows how to do something, it's a bit of a cliche, but Brazil does know how to have a good party and how to throw a good party. So I think that ultimately Rio will probably be remembered for all of the chaos that happened before it. But I wouldn't be surprised if the games actually turn out to be, you know, a great spectacle, a lot of fun, and to go off pretty much without any major serious hitches.
Well, one thing athletes and fans will get to enjoy is food. And Will, you have a story for us about a particular dish that's vegan friendly.
Yeah, so my story is actually about feijoada, the traditional Portuguese stew. And this is a stew that's normally made with pork scraps, like pig ears, feet and tails. Really, really kind of daunting. It's kind of a scary dish. And I found a restaurant that does a vegan version. So I spent some time down there.
All right, Will, let's hear it.
Chef Tatiana Lund is known to everyone in her kitchen as Tati. And today, she's cooking up a big pot of feijoada.
It's a kind of stew with many parts of animals. But here I make with tofu and pumpkin inside. And usually we eat with rice, farofa. It's another traditional dish here in Brazil that I love. And collards. It's a green leaf.
Tati owns .org Bistro. It's a tiny place. People line up at her door every day before she opens. And on Fridays and Saturdays, most of them are here for her signature vegan feijoada.
Because I try to make like everything that is traditional here in Brazil and make it in another way, in a healthy way. So that's my thing here.
Upstairs, in her small open kitchen, two of Tati's sous chefs chop piles of beets and collard greens. She leads me towards the back, where there's a thick smell of sizzling garlic. She takes me into a small room and shows me a huge pot with what looks like meat floating on top.
It looks like meat. That's the... And we put a... Como é defumado? I forgot.
Smoked?
Smoked tofu also. So it gets a flavor of the smoke.
Tati cooks beans and tofu, then adds a pile of garlic and onions and seaweed, then in goes the pumpkin, and it all cooks for several hours. Tati serves me up a plate of the vegan feijoada. It's pungent and delicious, and it's served with farofa, or toasted manioc flour, a sort of highly addictive sawdust that you use to sop up the gravy. While I'm eating, I let Tati in on my plan. I'm going to take her vegan feijoada and try it out on some locals to see what they make of it.
My advice is not telling them that it's vegan. Just tell that it's a traditional one and maybe nobody will tell. They won't know there is tofu inside, for sure.
Okay, that sounds like a challenge,
yeah.
Okay.
After I finished, Tati hands me a bag with two more servings and sends me out the door with a wave. A few blocks up the street, there's a strip of typical Brazilian botecos, or small roadside restaurants. Think wooden tables on the sidewalk, patrons drinking icy beer, and plates of stew and grilled meat appearing like magic from inside. I sit down at a table with Irismar Alves. He's a gnarly old dude, missing a few teeth. He tells me he's been cooking feijoada all day, just like he's been doing every Friday for years.
Toda sexta-feira eu faço.
Então você conhece muito bem a feijoada.
So you know your stuff, I ask him.
Não muito, mas eu entendo alguma coisa.
Yeah, not too much, but I know a few things about feijoada, he says. I'm almost nervous as I serve him some of Tati's still hot stew. He takes a few tentative bites, but he looks genuinely pleased. I ask him if it's good.
Tá gostoso?
Tá bom, sim, tá bom.
Yeah, he says, it's good. A little lacking in salt, and he likes to use black beans, but yeah, it's a tasty, traditional feijoada. Any other differences, I ask? Like, there's no meat in it? Yeah, I knew that, he says, after a bit of a pause.
Cada lugar tem cor diferente, né? Mas...
Everywhere has its style, he says. Ours here has pork in it, but theirs doesn't. That's just their style. And then a regular named Heitor Aguilar asks if he can try some. Heitor is two mouthfuls in when he figures out something's a bit different. What is this, he says? Soy meat? Tofu? Exactly, it's tofu, I tell him. The tofu, it's just like meat. It's a good consistency. It's interesting. I'm no vegetarian, but this is great, he says. I feel a bit relieved. I guess I didn't know what to expect. In South America, people get pretty opinionated about their meat. But who knows? Meatless feijoada could just be here to stay. For The World, Will Collis, Rio de Janeiro.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. In New Mexico, a new generation looks to the stars.
Do you see it now?
What do I do? I do.
What do you see?
Jupiter.
You see its little moons?
Yeah.
America's first dark sky sanctuary. That story plus an email scammer named Mike gets nabbed in Nigeria. Ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Senator John McCain today became the latest Republican leader to criticize his party's presidential nominee. McCain issued a statement condemning Donald Trump for his critical comments about Khazir and Ghazala Khan. They're the parents of Homayoun Khan, a Muslim U.S. Army captain who was killed in Iraq. Khazir Khan's speech at the Democratic National Convention, asking Trump if he'd ever read the Constitution, went viral. Trump reacted in part by suggesting that his wife Ghazala, who stood next to Khazir during the DNC speech, wasn't allowed to speak. This weekend, Ghazala Khan told ABC News how she felt about that comment.
I am very upset when I heard that. I didn't say anything because I was in a pain.
So much pain, said Mrs. Khan, that she didn't want to speak. I spoke about all this today with Taib Rashid. He's a Muslim American who served in the Marines. I asked him first how he felt watching Khazir Khan's speech at the DNC.
I was in awe. It was just such a proud moment for me as an American Muslim and a veteran. My heart was just filled with gratitude for Mr. Khan and his wife and the sacrifice that they've made for this nation, and just complete and total utmost respect to them.
Are you surprised by the reaction to Khazir Khan's speech?
I am very pleasantly surprised, in fact. I mean, I expected it to be received well, certainly, because I think, you know, America stands for freedom for everyone. And it's the diversity of our nation that makes us such a powerful force and such an exemplary nation for the rest of the world to follow. But the magnitude, you know, how positively it has been received, certainly was a very, very pleasant surprise.
And what was your reaction to Donald Trump's comments about Khazir Khan over the weekend?
My reaction to him was just of utmost disgust. Mr. Trump continues to violate every constitutional principle that allows for equality and freedom and dignity for all the U.S. citizens. And it is completely contrary to the American principles for which I fought and which I defended and could still continue to defend.
In one of your talks, you described telling your father, who is a Muslim missionary, that you wanted to leave college and join the Marines. What was his reaction?
Before I actually told my father, I was really conflicted about how I would tell my father because I expected him to react negatively and try to talk me out of it. His reaction was actually quite frankly the opposite. He was very calm. He was very collected. And he asked me, he said, give me the reasons why you wanted to do this. You know, help me understand why is it that you wanted to do this. I explained to him that, look, I really desire to do something great with my life. I want to serve my country. I came here as an immigrant. I want to have the right to claim that, hey, look, I'm a citizen who served this country. He was my biggest fan. He was 100% supportive. And even now, I mean, he's extremely proud father and always mentions to, you know, his colleagues and friends about my particular service in the Marine Corps.
Where did you serve as a Marine?
So I served for 5 years active duty. I went to boot camp out in San Diego and later at Camp Pendleton. My permanent duty station was actually Cherry Point. I was in the avionics wing. I deployed 3 times. The first one was in support of the Kosovo operation. The second time I deployed in support of Operation Southern Watch over Iraq. And the third time I deployed was a training mission to an Air Force base in Simbach, Germany.
Tayyip, what was it like for you to serve as a Muslim American in the Marines? Were there odd moments or are we just projecting?
My time in the Marine Corps is, I reflect upon it with great fondness. It was among the best years of my life, and particularly because of the way that I was received. I think one of the more interesting things I noted while I was in the Marines was that for many of my fellow comrades, I was the first Muslim that they had ever met. But at no point in time did I ever experience any kind of racism or any kind of bigotry from my Marine comrades. If anything, it was just with utmost admiration and respect that they would ask me questions about Islam and, you know, out of curiosity, and always treated me with, you know, as one of their own. I never felt different in any way, shape, or form.
Are there any misconceptions or thoughts you'd like to share about the Muslim community in the United States as it relates to the kinds of things Trump is saying about Muslims?
Yes, I think first and foremost is the misconception that Muslims are not loyal to this country. And I think that that is the biggest misconception and something that our faith tells us to be loyal to the nation in which we reside. And that was one of the foremost reasons why I enlisted in the Marine Corps. And one of the reasons why, quite frankly, I believe Humayun Khan enlisted in the Army. And so we are loyal to this nation. We want what's best for the United States and for our citizens. And we're willing to sacrifice just as much, if not more, than anybody else to ensure that we discharge our duties and responsibilities as American citizens.
The comments Donald Trump made about the Khan family, do they hurt you more as a Muslim or as a Marine?
I think they hurt me more as an American first, because I think the comments that he makes are completely contrary to the constitutional principles and the freedoms that we stand for. Secondly, they offend me as a Marine, and lastly, as a Muslim. So I think Mr. Trump has a long way to go in understanding the standards of decency before he can become the president of the United States.
Tayyip Rashid is a Muslim American, and he served in the Marines. Thanks, Tayyip.
Thank you.
We think it's really important to hear the perspectives of current and former military personnel like Tayyip. In fact, we have an online group of veterans who often help inform our coverage. If you want in, you can join that community. Just text RETURN to the number 69866. That's RETURN to 69866. One of the key security issues facing whoever becomes president in November is the relationship with Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin has challenged the international legal order in recent years by sending troops into Crimea prior to its annexation by Russia and through Russia's military intervention in other parts of Ukraine. Republican candidate Donald Trump was asked about these issues yesterday in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
He's not going into Ukraine, okay? Just so you understand, he's not going to go into Ukraine. All right, you can mark it down, you can put it down, you can take it anywhere
you want. Well,
he's
already there, isn't he?
Okay. Well, he's there in a certain way, but I'm not there. You have Obama there. And frankly, that whole part of the world is a mess under Obama.
Hillary Clinton's campaign says these comments and others seem to show that Trump has no idea what's going on in Ukraine. The Republican nominee has repeatedly said it would be good for the United States to have a strong relationship with Russia. And it turns out Trump's campaign chairman and chief strategist, Paul Manafort, has some interesting ties to the region. Andrew Kramer is Moscow correspondent for The New York Times. Andrew, you wrote this very interesting piece in your newspaper. How did you go about figuring out Paul Manafort's connection to Ukraine?
Well, thank you very much for having me on. We set about writing about the last campaign that Paul Manafort was involved in before he joined Trump's campaign in the United States. And it turns out that Manafort had been working in Ukraine for more than a decade as an advisor to a pro-Russian party called the Party of Regions. And he continued his work in Ukraine up until September 2015, just a few months before joining the Trump campaign.
So that's a long stretch of time. And I understand he was really the person representing and trying to boost the image of former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. What were his efforts and how successful were they?
Well, that's right. He tried to sand off some of the rough edges on Yanukovych, who's a very Soviet-style politician. And with Manafort's advice, he became smoother in his presentation at rallies in Ukraine. Manafort's role also involved strategy, and he was advising Yanukovych to exploit wedge issues in Ukraine.
And of course, Yanukovych was a pro-Russian president of Ukraine.
That's right. And in particular, the issue of the Russian language. He was encouraging Yanukovych to suggest that he would enshrine the Russian language as an official second language in Ukraine. And this proved quite effective in winning votes in the south and east of Ukraine in particular. But it was very divisive and really exploited ethnic and linguistic differences inside this country, which is quite fragile.
And how successful was Manafort in the end?
He was very successful. His client, Yanukovych, won the presidential election in 2010. He went on to then imprison his primary opponent, Yulia Tymoshenko, about a year later. And in spite of this, which elicited quite a bit of criticism in the West, Manafort stayed on as an advisor to Yanukovych when Yanukovych was president in Ukraine.
So it's sort of we don't know what happened first, Donald Trump's pro-Russian views or Manafort possibly advising him. But it is interesting that they both share a kind of favorable view of Russia. What's the evidence that Manafort is advising Trump on this matter?
Well, there's some anecdotal evidence. For example, the plank in the Republican platform about Ukraine was changed to eliminate language which would have advocated for providing lethal weapons to Ukraine to defend against Russian-supported insurrection in eastern Ukraine.
I'm curious, are you aware of any Russian or Ukrainian groups tied to or lobbying the Clinton campaign?
I'm not aware of any specific groups now, but the Clintons have had long-standing ties to one Ukrainian oligarch, Mr. Pinchuk, and I believe that Bill Clinton has, at least on one occasion, traveled to Ukraine to meet with him.
Andrew Kramer is Moscow correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Sure, thank you.
Astronomers want to keep you in the dark, in a good way. See, light pollution from urban centers has now gotten so bad that more than half the people on Earth can't see the Milky Way. And by the way, darkness isn't just necessary to see the stars. It's also critical for human health. Monica Ortiz Oribe tells us about a remote campground in New Mexico that's trying to prove that.
It's called the Cosmic Campground. The name alone evokes a kind of giddy mystique. You'll find it in the largest and most remote county in southwest New Mexico, where traffic lights don't exist, and the U.S. Census counts only half a person per square mile.
Oh, the thing of it is, you can see a 360 here, and you can see the last star of the Big Dipper come up over the edge of the Gila Wilderness.
Annie Grauer's got a kid's enthusiasm for starry skies. She and her husband, a 74-year-old astronomer, were part of a team effort that created the Cosmic Campground. They found a spot just off a two-lane highway in the Gila National Forest and used special instruments to measure the darkness in the sky.
What we did was we would come about once a week, and we did that for about 3 months, 4 months.
They sent the data to the International Dark Sky Association, a group dedicated to protecting places with little or no light pollution. IDA reviewed the data, and in January, they designated the site as a dark sky sanctuary, only the second in the world. The other is in the Elqui Valley of northern Chile.
This sky is so dark, and there are so many stars up there that actually it's lighter than you would imagine. And one night we were up here, and I was walking around out here. I was scared by my own shadow. Star shadow. I could see my shadow by starlight.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. I'm going to read a message from Senator Udall.
On a recent summer afternoon, a crowd of amateur astronomers and science nerds gathered at the Cosmic Campground to celebrate the sanctuary designation. Next to the potluck table, Deborah Calkins and her son Michael wrap red cellophane on a flashlight to help dim its intensity at night.
I think we're ready for sunset.
Turns out, Michael had just gotten a telescope for his 12th birthday.
I like science and I'm interested in the stars.
Michael is lucky. Scientists estimate that 83% of the world's population lives under light-polluted skies. Among other things, people need darkness to help maintain a healthy hormonal balance. Animals like nocturnal birds and sea turtles need it to migrate, reproduce, and find food.
Okay, who wants to see Saturn?
I'd like to see.
Okay.
After sunset, astronomer Al Grauer sets up his telescope and invites fellow campers to take a peek.
Just want to look straight down into there.
Okay.
And there's a little knob that you just rotate a hair one way or the other till it's the sharpest.
Okay, just look in here?
Yeah.
Oh wow. That's amazing. Almost looks like a UFO.
Yeah.
As more scientists recognize the benefit of limiting illumination, more places are working to reduce light pollution. France passed a law in 2013 that requires businesses to shut off their lights late at night. In October, the IDA recognized a dark sky park in South Korea, its first designation in Asia.
Okay, it's going to be high to see. You have to get up on the stool.
At the Cosmic Campground, Cindy Neely helps her 3-year-old granddaughter, Veda, onto a stool so she can peer into the family telescope.
Do you see it now?
What do I do? I do.
What do you see?
Jupiter.
Do you see its little moons?
Yeah.
Count the moons.
1, 2, 3. There's 3.
For astronomer Al Grauer and his wife, these are the moments that make their efforts worthwhile. They hope to spread the word about the Cosmic Campground to kids in urban areas via their website and a podcast called Travelers in the Night.
Astronomy has ignited kids' imagination and humans' imagination from the beginning. And so, what's the price of imagination? You know, I mean, where does the next generation of poets and scientists and engineers come from?
One answer, he says, is to look to the heavens.
All right, so come on over and take a peek at Saturn.
For the world, Monica Ortiz Uribe, Catron County, New Mexico.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. You know those emails promising you money if you first just send your bank details? Well, one of the kings of those scammer letters was arrested today. He's a 40-year-old Nigerian national known only as Mike. With me is Nigerian journalist Sam Olukoya. He's in Lagos. Sam, what kind of crimes is he accused of committing?
It's just a normal, what the Nigerians call 419, which is the advance fee fraud, collecting money from people fraudulently. And this happens in several forms. In his own case, he's believed to have hacked into the account of some
just
medium
ahead,
and small scale establishments
gets his come
into
up
the email account
on the
and
world.
Using that to ask people to pay money. That's maybe people who are trading with these companies, asking them to pay money into accounts which he controlled. And these people are assuming that these accounts belong to the companies they have been dealing with.
Are these kind of scams that he's alleged to have committed, did they go on all over the world, in Nigeria, everywhere? Like, how far and wide was he scamming people?
Well, I think wherever you have people living, human beings living, this scam, and wherever you have internet available, this scam go to anywhere, so long as there is internet. All they do is go on the internet. They have softwares. If you are gullible enough to respond, then it becomes a problem.
How much money is somebody like Mike supposed to have made over these scams?
We're talking of about $60 million. So, I mean, you can understand how elaborate this type of scam is. If somebody has made as much as $60 million, that doesn't come really easy. And there are many people who are into this also trying to make a living from this. And I must say that It's quite a thriving business. One, it's so easy to establish. I mean, you just need a few $100 to buy a computer, buy internet modem, and then buy data. And that's a thriving business.
Have you yourself ever encountered a scam artist in Nigeria?
Well, I get these things every day, every day. Well, one of those I got about 3 days ago. It came as an SMS, and it was as if it came from my bank that my ATM card has been deactivated. They said you should call a number to reactivate it. And I knew it was a scam. But I imagine that so many people will have called the same number. What he will have done will have been to get the details on the card, and when he gets this detail, he will definitely empty their bank account.
Sam Olukoya is a Nigerian journalist speaking to us from Lagos. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks so much.
It's pretty common around the globe to find musicians in non-English-speaking countries who write songs in English, particularly if the language spoken in that country isn't widely used elsewhere. English lyrics can help reach a wider audience. So it's not surprising to meet some punk musicians in Albania who sing in English. But as Nate Tabak reports from the Albanian capital, Tirana, this is a band that also uses English to get around local sensitivities.
It starts with the band's name, Premenstrual Syndrome. It's pretty on the nose.
We have a lot of quiet songs, and we have a lot of really angry and irritated songs. So that's PMS for you.
Wendy Pustina, she's 19 and plays the drums and writes most of the lyrics for the self-described feminist punk band. The tattoo on her left bicep really stands out. It says Sisterhood. Above, there's a red bow, a diamond, and two baseball bats.
Because of my personality, my mom still calls me her little boy. And that's not okay, because just because I am extroverted and impulsive, that doesn't mean I am not a girl or I am not girlish, girly.
Pustina studies chemistry, and she doesn't fit the mold of a typical young woman in Albania. The same goes for her three bandmates, and that can get pretty frustrating in this socially conservative country. You're here for my entertainment. You're here for my judgment. You're here for my
insecurities. You're here for my insecurities. The songs themselves are four angry girls telling the world to go I can say that.
Pustina and the other members of PMS aren't used to having to watch what they say, at least not in English. That's one of the reasons why the band does all of their songs in English.
We have it as a sort of protection.
At this point, bassist Megi Andoni chimes in.
If we wrote our songs in Albanian, it would come off as vulgar, and they would not really listen to what we're saying, but criticize us on that.
The songs use plenty of profanity, but far more provocative is the subject matter. They take on things like sex, rape, cheating, sexting.
If we were about to sing or write the lyrics in Albanian, people would mostly think it really happened to us. And when you write the lyrics in English, people just think you're a social activist.
So what's the big deal if people think the songs are true? The band says they'd be labeled as promiscuous and wild. They'd be judged personally. But the songs are deeply personal, like this one, Damn Relationships. You're so fine, like you're asking to be mine. With your weird arrow held up and your strength saying no stop. And I'm not stopping, no, you're like you're making me go again and again and again. I asked Pustina what would happen if she did the song in Albanian.
Being a girl, talking about sex, talking about an affair with a guy in a relationship would be like, whoa. It's too much controversy. Like, if you want to work with these people, you should do a bit of controversy, but still not too traumatized. And who knows, maybe we'll run up together,
leave you behind. I point out to the band that this story will probably be heard in Albania, including by their parents. Stories about Albania usually get translated here,
if there are people, including maybe our parents, who may be angry at us,
we'll get over it.
We'll
probably fight a bit, but that's okay. They will still love us.
Yeah.
So,
plus, it will be better for people to actually know about what we're saying.
For now, the band is working on their first EP in English. It comes out later this year. For The World, Nate Tabak, Tirana.
That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.